Those who love theater may know him for his plays Blood Wedding and The House of Bernarda Alba. Federico García Lorca was an internationally known poet, playwright, and theater director born near Granada in Spain in 1898. Lorca loved music, and we're told he turned to writing only after the death of his beloved music teacher. Ralph Angel, an American poet, was gripped by the poetry of García Lorca, and he felt in his bones that he needed to translate Lorca's Poem of the Deep Song into English. He did so and tells us what it was like attempting to live inside the Poema del Gante Hondo. I won't indulge myself here by recalling all the reasons why I took on the project. It's enough to say that music itself became a constant companion. Lorca was a minstrel, and he understood poetry as an oral expression. I found that in order to come to terms with these spare, peculiar poems, I had to come to terms with Cante Hondo. Only by studying Cante Hondo and translating lyrics of songs that moved me and listening to Cante Hondo while I worked, did I begin to hear the strange, subtle rhythms and silences and accents of the poems. But I found myself listening to other music as well, to other forms of flamenco, for example, to medieval Arabic and Jewish music, and to American jazz. I found myself going to the music of duende, of which Cante Hondo is a supreme example, including the American duende of Billie Holiday, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, John Lee Hooker, and Ramblin' Jack Elliott. American duende was especially important to me during those periods I spent living and working in Granada. There I was thinking and speaking in Spanish. I slid into the ways of Andalusian culture, and it helped me to hear the language of the original poems. But listening to the music of American duende, music I've known and loved for years, helped me to hear my own language, the language of translation. What is the language of this translation? It isn't anything without Granada, the Spanish language, English music, the almost mythological life of García Lorca, and the elements of deep song. In 1921, Federico García Lorca made a book of poems to be titled Poema del Cante Hondo. He was 23. It was his first mature work in the sense that the poems were not centered on his own interior life. In fact, they were not about him at all. They were inspired by a festival of Cante Hondo that he and the great Spanish composer Manuel de Falla were organizing. The festival would take place in 1922 in the Alhambra, and like its ancient Moorish setting, would remind Andalusia and all of Spain of its deep musical soul. Lorca referred to Cante Hondo as a stammer, a wavering emission of the voice that makes the tightly closed flowers of the semitones blossom into a thousand petals. Cante Hondo is the trilling of birds, he said, the song of the rooster, and the music of forest and fountain. It is a very rare specimen of primitive song, the oldest in all Europe, and its notes carry the naked emotion of the first of these races. Cante Hondo is highly stylized singing. In each song, the singer or cantaor must convey his or her own suffering within the compás of its complex rhythms. And the compás is a strange, unique fluidity, full of discrete interruptions, accents, and silences. In the Poem of the Deep Song, Lorca did not try to imitate the lyrics or music of the Cante Hondo, but he did rely on its rhythms in order to craft poems that would enact the experience of the solitary anguish that is Cante Hondo. The wine glasses of dawn are broken. The cry of the guitar begins. That from the poem titled The Guitar. The cry is essential to Cante. Not unlike the guitar, the voice of the cantaor is considered an instrument of the cry that dares to break the silence, just as the hands are an instrument to break the stillness and the feet. The cry. The ellipse of a cry echoes from mountain to mountain. From the olive trees, a black rainbow veils the blue night. Aye, like the bow of a viola, the cry vibrates long strings of wind. Aye, the cave dwellers' oil lamps begin to appear. Lorca loved Cantejondo, and he believed it had to be preserved because it was only gypsy music, as he called it, the music of the persecuted, the ones who were oppressed. From Indian and Andalusia folk song, together with the song of the Arabs and Jews, the gypsies of southern Spain developed and defined Cantejondo, the song of Andalusia, and infused it with Duende, a lecture that Lorca first delivered in Buenos Aires in 1933. In that lecture, he described Duende as a black sound. Poem of the Deep Song did not appear in 1922 as Lorca intended it. It was published 10 years after it was begun, in 1931, in part because he abandoned it to work on a brilliant, even more traditional collection he titled The Gypsy Ballads, which was eventually to make Lorca hugely famous. Deep Song's publication then occurred only 5 years before he returned to Granada for the last time in the summer of 1936 to be part of his family's annual celebration of his and his father's Saint's Day. 4 days after Lorca returned home, Francisco Franco, with the blessing of Hitler and Mussolini, initiated his famed rebellion from the Canary Islands. The Spanish Civil War had begun, and a month later, by then in hiding, Lorca was arrested. He was taken to the Barranco de Biznar, a ravine to the hills northeast of Granada, and murdered. He was 38, and not until after Franco's death in 1975 were his writings or the details of his assassination openly discussed in Spain. And ever since Franco's death, all the great cante singers of Spain have been turning Lorca poems into song. Angel says it has been my privilege to join them in their homage to the art of García Lorca. Words of the late poet, Ralph Angel, who won the Willis Barnstone Translation Award for his Lorca volume. Angel titled his essay, The Words We Just Heard, attempting to live inside Federico García Lorca's Poema del Cantejondo for a while. And Jason Smeltzer, with his program series The Old Stories, will present a performing experience with music and words that should give us a chance to live inside the poetry and music of García Lorca for a while. This Sunday in Scranton and the following Sunday in Wilkes-Barre. The title is The Surreal and Folkloric. Jason Smeltzer stopped in at the WVIA studios to give us a sense of the way The Old Stories presents its programs and what's in store with The Surreal and the Folkloric.
The tendency is that I'll take something that we all find a bit arcane, you know, something where you need to pave the way a little bit. Things like Kafka and, you know, familiar names, but at the same time, mysterious. And when you read it, you don't feel like you've gotten it. And in doing these things, and hopefully it's the same for me as for an audience, is I'm hoping that after hearing it performed, that one says, oh, now I get it. Or at least a little bit more. You'll never get it. But we're here to help.
And so you really are opening the door wider.
Mm-hmm. Whether they know it or not. And usually a tendency, it's not something I initially did deliberately, but a tendency with these shows is I'm usually putting something together that I don't completely understand myself. but that usually requires me to do a little extra homework and dig a little deeper. And usually, if I'm lucky, and in this case as well, I usually involve a reader who knows much more about the subject than I do.
And the subjects of the past have included Rumi.
Rumi. We did some Middle Eastern poetry, and that's an ocean. We were lucky to have someone who really knew her material there. We did, oddly enough, you wouldn't think of it as being hard to understand, but we had the Lurrus Carol Night a while ago. And we did one of his lesser-known works, and the thing with that being lesser-known was that it really required paving the way. There's so many London time period puns and references that the story doesn't, it's not funny yet. You know it's supposed to be, but you have to help it be funny again. And we've done Kafka and Italo Calvino, just very arcane things that can make sense if you see them framed, I guess you would say.
And you are a musician yourself, and you have friends or associates or some people you know about who are musicians as well. So you can put together an ensemble in this way that can do the kinds of opening up that you need.
It's nice to have a pool of musicians. It's interesting that I usually involve musicians who don't know what they're getting into, but I kind of can pick and choose and know what their strengths are. And also the storytelling element, especially with the improvisers with jazz vocabularies, or if I'm really lucky, a classical vocabulary that is not afraid of improvisation, it gives them a platform where they can do what they can't do with anyone else. And usually, like if they're pushing the sonic spectrum beyond where an audience who's not familiar with the material, if it's adding to the story, then no one questions it. The challenge is no longer a challenge. It's part of the coloration. And also we know when to stop.
And how did you settle on Federico García Lorca?
Ah, he's been a study of mine for a long time. And initially, as far as me delving into him, I mainly connected with his work, and this is a little bit lesser known. He and Manuel de Falla toured the Spanish countryside, saving a lot of folklore songs from obscurity. So there's a lot of pieces that he didn't write, but mainly he saved them. There's a wax recording. He wouldn't write them down. He wanted it to be more oral tradition. So there's a wax recording of him doing these dozen pieces or so. And over the years, many people have transcribed them. It's amazing how many different versions of them. And then you have his poetry on the other side of it, where it's amazing how many compositions. And I remember when I ran into Shostakovich had done a Lorca poem in one of his symphonies. I would have lost a bet on that because it's not what you're thinking.
So this is a program then that will feature the poetry of Lorca, and what is the music that will enhance that?
So there's two completely separate elements. I'm integrated a little bit, but mainly the new guitar professor at Marywood is Diogo Carvalho. And I had mentioned this to him, and he took the ball and ran with it. Not what I was expecting. He handed the folklore music over to one of his composition students and arranged it for the Marywood Guitar Ensemble. So there's these really, and I've done it with guitarists before, but as an ensemble, it's this whole different sound. And since it's Marywood, we have three vocalists. So the folklore pieces, for the first time in any of my projects, will be sung in Spanish. And I'm doing a couple pieces straightforward with that on the theremin. But for the poetry part of it, then there'll be a whole different musical texture going on with me playing, reciting, and also Joanne Reif. She is very familiar with the Lorca material. She probably will not be reading with so much musical accompaniment, but she studied Spanish, and she tells me that her Spanish teacher was in Lorca's theater group in Spain. So she's on board.
And what about the focus? Is it an assortment of Lorca poetry collections? Have you drawn on the collections that feature the guitar as subjects?
I do have a few with the guitar as subjects. That's one of his 10, and it just made sense with the guitar ensemble. I didn't want to do it so much that it becomes silly, but they're very strong even in and of themselves. And there's a possibility of even reading those over an ensemble piece as well. The overall poetry arc is a little bit of everything. Some published after he was assassinated and some before. And basically anything, essentially I chose about a dozen of them and just lived with them. So even there's a couple different performances. So I probably will do something different, you know, from one performance to the other, whatever comes out.
We have a sense, don't we, that this will not necessarily be poetry that is sunny and bright. There's this sense of perhaps the yearning and the sadness that is often associated with Lorca.
It's definitely, I like the word arcane, but there's definitely a dark side to it. And one of his, you're probably familiar, one of his amazing lectures, and I'd love to just do something with it sometime on the Duende. It's poetry in and of itself. One thing that kind of helps at least see the direction of what he's saying with Duende is in the lecture, he does compare it to the muse and the angel. Duende is unlike the muse and the angel. And he's also careful to point out that even though there's a darkness to it and there's kind of a dance with death element, but it's also not like the devil trying to trick you. It's much more colorful than that. But one of the lines in one of his lectures is how the angel guides and grants like Saint Raphael, defends and spars like Saint Michael, proclaims and forewarns like Saint Gabriel. But he points out that the angel and the muse come from outside us, and more so that the Duende comes from inside. There's even a reference of a singer saying it comes from the soles of your feet.
When you put together a program like this, you have the sensibility of a musician. So even if it's not all music, you have the sense of rhythm and tone and flow. You used the word arc. Mm-hmm. So have you established that yet?
In a way that Lorca would appreciate, this one is strangely blind and by the seat of our pants. The ensemble really has no idea what I'm up to. And the best understanding I have of how Diogo is arranging it is that there'll be kind of windows. There'll be a couple pieces, and then they'll open it up to me. And there again, they don't know how completely polar opposite that's going to be. And as well as Joanne, we'll do some reading and introduction as well as that, and then back to the ensemble and let everyone recover and so on and so forth, because I'm going deep. You can't softly do this. You have to mean it. And you had mentioned rhythm, too, in something in another lecture that I got much more familiar with this time around is his interest in Deep Song, which I'd heard of, I think even as a collection called Deep Song. And in a lecture, he gets into that and specifically references something called the Sigiriya rhythm. And Joanne will pronounce that much better than I will. And none of the folklore pieces are in that meter. But there's one poem that relates to it, and it does reference to its being headless. If I'm understanding just the basics of it, the headlessness of it is that it's a series of threes and twos. It's a 12-beat pattern that they actually count in five, because it's easier to pay attention to the accents. So they count it, and a musician is going to be confused by this, but they count it one and two and three and a four and a five. And so to ground what I'm doing, because it's what I'm doing is musically very ambiguous, in contrast with the ensemble, they're doing very folkloric pieces. I figured the least I could do to help ground the audience is everything I do, almost everything I do will be to that rhythm. And also at the same tempo. So it'll be surreal, but there'll be something to hold on to.
Only theremin for you?
A couple other weird, something called a Eurorack, which will also be in the Sigiriya rhythm, which I'm going to say no one's done that. No one's trained a Eurorack to be a Spanish or anything like that. But Eurorack I generally describe as being I compare it to Philip Glass a little bit. It's very much of a pattern manipulating, modulating, and softly controllable enough while I'm playing the theremin and reading. I know that it's really too much, but it works. And for those who aren't familiar, a theremin was invented in the 1920s, essentially the first musical instrument to use electricity, and also the only musical instrument that you don't touch. Essentially, it came with the invention of the radio. for lack of better description, you are grounding out a sound. The closer you are to the instrument, the higher the pitch is, and the closer you are to another antenna, the quieter it is. And it's not a realistic instrument at all, but it has survived all these years to some degree. And it applies very well to storytelling.
Should we prepare? We just want to come and be open? How do you hope your audience will approach this?
My goal with all of these is the less you know, the more you might get out of it. But essentially, it would be for everybody, too. Like, if you are familiar with Lorca, I've never had anyone be disappointed in one of my shows. I was really tickled when we did the Italo Calvino. Italo Calvino has a book called Invisible Cities, which are very imagined conversations between Marco Polo and Kublai Khan. And the handful of people in the audience who were familiar with it, you know, came up and talked to me afterwards. And it's like, yeah, you did the only thing you possibly could have done with that. I have more stories along those lines, but that's what we want. That's what we want.
You said that you have been with Lorca for a long time. How has he grown on you? You've gone deeper then, right?
Every time. It's another notch. The first solid contact was my introduction to the music. Jay Stavetsky, a classical guitarist in the area who actually started the Classical Guitar Society at Scranton. And we had a collaboration a while ago, and I had never heard of the pieces. Well, he was so enthusiastic about doing something with vocal material but not using a vocalist, so the sky was the limit for him. So he gave me everything he'd ever run into, and I saw those, and I really didn't know what to think. Like I knew the name Lorca, but as far as whether these were compositions or what they were, like, I dug into what was even going on. Because as far as him being accredited with them but not having written them but just kind of saved them from obscurity. And that kind of started me down the rabbit hole. And after that, the friend of mine who helped me start the old stories initially, one of our projects was a Lorca Blake night. And in that case, I just did the pieces with a classical guitarist, and Robert and another Lorcaist friend of ours, Philip Mosley, did an amazing job of reciting without musical accompaniment. So this will be completely different from that, but there again, taking it a step deeper.
Will you tell us anything about Lorca's biography other than the fact that maybe he and Faya went out and collected folk material?
It'd be hard not to do that. As far as histories and things like that, this is very informal, but we are prepared. And I always open up things for questions because nothing I do is right there on the surface. It's always good to reel people in and have you good questions. And Joanne as well. She'll be a wealth of information.
You always have an eye-catching poster to accompany these events, and this one is especially so. Tell us what you've come up with.
Well, it wasn't easy. So the poster features two Lorca drawings that have always been favorites. And in this case, also, nothing available online was of poster quality. And I had wondered if there might be a book somewhere just of Lorca's drawings. Because he wasn't really a professional artist, but for a lot of his plays and manuscripts, he would just illustrate them. And they always just touch you in the right spot. And I was lucky enough, it took us a while. I asked my library on Greenridge Street, it's like, can you look up? And we didn't have any luck, and I delved a little deeper, and I did find such a thing. And they got it for me, and it was huge. It was hard to scan. It was so big. And there's one other thing I must reference for this. One of Lorca's other contemporaries and friends was Salvador Dali. I guess this was during Lorca's lifetime. There was actually an exhibition of his work, and Salvador Dali was one of the curators of it. And in the book of Lorca's drawings, it says, "The observation was made humorously by Salvador Dali, who was reviewing an exhibition of Lorca's drawings at the Galleria del Mau, Barcelona, in 1927. And he said, and I'm sure this is a translation, Lorca's recently exhibited drawings have a poetical and aphrodisiastical plasticity, and yet, at least for us painters from the Ampurdan, they have a deficit that will probably never be found in our own work. The deficit, which seems more attractive by the moment, is that they are absolutely exquisite."
How can we take part?
The first show is Sunday, March 22nd at 5 p.m. at the Rossetti House in Scranton. And that one, too, I should mention, we have a Lackawanna grant for. Thanks. Thank you, Lackawanna. They're always very good to me. And a week later, it's the first time I've been at the Circle Center in a long time. That one will be March 29th at 3 p.m. And this will be a kickoff of something they used to do called Sunday at the Circle. and they've just not been able to get it rolling. So this will be the maiden voyage of the second coming of the Circle Center, Sunday at the Circle. But that one is Sunday, March 29th at 3 p.m.
Cante Hondo with Carlos Montoya. This interview was conducted with musician, writer, and creative spirit Jason Smeltzer, artistic director of the performance series The Old Stories, speaking about a program titled The Surreal and Folkloric, the music and poetry of Federico García Lorca and others. A multidisciplinary concert project exploring Lorca's poetic and musical legacy through spoken word, guitar ensemble, and vocal performance, blending surrealism, folklore, and Spanish cultural traditions. There are two concerts, one this Sunday and one the following. This Sunday, March 22nd at 5 p.m. at the Rossetti Foundation in Scranton, there will be a performance. And the Rossetti Foundation is located at 1005 Vine Street in Scranton. And in both places, the Merriwood Guitar Ensemble will be featured, directed by Diogo Carvalho. Admission is free. Donations are welcome. The next Sunday, March 29th, you can experience the surreal and the folkloric at the Circle Center for the Arts, home of the Wyoming Valley Art League, 130 South Franklin Street, Rear in downtown Wilkes-Barre. That again is at 3. The Rossetti Foundation performance is at 5 o'clock. So Sunday the 22nd in Scranton, Sunday March 29th in downtown Wilkes-Barre. The Sunday program is supported by a grant from the Lackawanna County Department of Arts and Culture.